Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, 888-914-9149. That's the number to call to be on the air, 888-914-9149. An interesting but actually rather depressing study. The Wall Street Journal has an article about this. There's a new study that was done by the University of Chicago, and it's billed as a nonpartisan research organization, NORC, and this is at the University of Chicago, a nonpartisan research organization, found in its recent survey that this country, these United States, are sharply divided by political party over social trends such as the push for racial diversity in businesses, the use of gender neutral pronouns, etc. But it gets into other things too, like patriotism and religion and other things like this. And it's well worth your time to take a look at this, at least just to get a sense of where things are headed. I'll give you some snippets from the article. Some 38% of the respondents said patriotism was very important to them, and 39% said religion was very important. Now, those are low numbers, 38%. That was down sharply from when the journal first asked these questions in 1998. At that time, 70% of the people who were surveyed said that patriotism is very important, 70%. And now it's 38%. At that time, 1998, 62% of the people surveyed said that religion was very important to them, and now it's 39%, and it's trending downward, steadily downward. And there's some charts and graphs in this article that kind of make it easier to see, but they look at it across different filters. So they're looking at it in terms of age. They look at what different age groups, you know, under 30, what do they say, over 30, and you see this decided shift in the younger generations away from things like patriotism and religion and community service and things like that. They look at it across political lines as well, Democrat and Republican. Back in the day, Republicans and Democrats had a sense of deference to one another, says one of the people who was surveyed. They didn't act like they were in a schoolyard trying to be vengeful and reactive. Well, I think, you know, when you look back on history, things get a little cloudy. There's always been a lot of political division in this country. And when you go back and you look at some of the controversies that existed between Republicans and Democrats, you'll see some pretty horrendous divisions in the past. I think one of the things that makes it all the more different now than it was before is social media. You didn't have social media. You couldn't sound off. I mean, you could write a letter to the editor, but other than that, you had no way of voicing your opinion publicly for other people everywhere to read it. Now you can. If Elon Musk says something that you think one way or the other about on Twitter, you can tell him that, and he will see your comment. We never had that kind of access to people. We didn't have the kind of access to politicians and people in government and other people that we have today. So I think this is one of the things that is propelling this downward trend of a lot of people who are, they're changing their mores. And a lot of it is shaped by society. That's true. In politics, that's true. But it's certainly amplified, and probably it's accelerated on the basis of social media and the way that you can change people's opinion very rapidly using social media. Isn't that amazing when you think about it? If back in the 60s or 70s or 80s or even into the early 90s anyway, if you had a strong opinion about something, there was no way for you to make that known to anybody. Unless you had a platform, and few people had platforms. And then suddenly everybody's got a blog. Remember those days when everybody had a blog? Most all of those blogs eventually withered and died because there weren't enough people reading them for them to be sustainable. Very few of them survived, but it was back in the time where everybody had a blog. And now the new thing is podcasts. Everybody has a podcast. So everybody's out there podcasting, and maybe only to 30, 40, 50, 100, 200 people. And I think the same winnowing effect is going to take place in due time, where just like it used to be that everybody had a blog and now not so much. Now people have shifted to Facebook and Twitter, microblogging, things like that. But there just aren't enough people to read any given blog unless you're really good. I think the same thing will wind up being true for podcasts. But in any case, these methods and means of social media have shaped people's attitudes. And if you want to read about it and see where things are trending and things that are becoming very important to people, like using gender-neutral pronouns, that's shifting in the other direction. 888-914-9149. Also, I want to share with you, this is for your good-to-know file. It's a hot-button issue. Autism rates are rising in the U.S. They're not just rising, they're skyrocketing, according to study finds. This is an interesting article for you to read. Autism rates are rising and changing quickly in the United States. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reveals. Researchers from the University of California, San Diego, provide a close look into what this means and how California in particular is seeing record numbers of autism. The latest analysis shows that 1 in 36 American 8-year-olds have been diagnosed with autism. Now that's 2.8% of the total. So 1 in 36 American 8-year-old kids have been diagnosed with autism. This is notably higher than the reported 1 in 44% of children back in 2021. And it looks even steeper when you compare it to the CDC's first autism prevalence report in 2007, and that showed it was only 1 in 150 children. Okay, let me restate those figures for you. In 2007, the CDC did this report, how prevalent is autism in kids? And at that point is 0.7%, so less than 1%, or 1 in every 150 children had autism or are autistic. And I know there's certain sensibilities about how to say that, and forgive me if I'm not saying it the way you prefer. I'm just looking at how it's stated in the article. So 1 in 150 children dealing with autism in 2007. 2021, 1 in 44. That's a big jump. And now, as of the latest numbers, 1 in 36. So the number is shrinking. And I don't know what the trend... I don't know, you know, if we can factor out like how much more that may go, but if it went from 1 in 150 to 1 in 44 to now 1 in 36, you wonder how low is that going to go. Now, they have all the statistics in here about how the samples were taken and, you know, what were the age groups and how they did this. So this is all scientifically peer-reviewed, but the question that rises in my mind is, okay, why is this happening? Why is this happening? What is it that's causing this? Certainly, there must be some answer to that question. I don't know the answer. I don't claim to know the answer. I'm aware of the controversy about immunizations. I'm aware of that controversy. I've done a bit of reading on it to try to be knowledgeable up to a certain point, but I know that's been a raging controversy for a long time. But something's happening. If 2007, it was 1 in 150 children, and now it's 1 in 36 children, something is happening. Something is causing this, and I'd like to know what it is. I don't have any little kids anymore, but I have grandkids. So for the sake of my people, and your people too, and all those other people out there, I'd like to know what's causing this. So if you're interested, and especially if you're a young mom or dad and you're raising your kids and you want to know more about this. This is coming from the CDC, so it's not like, you know, some fringy group or anything. And there's a lot in here that will help you make plans for your own kids. 888-914-9149. Let's get back to the phones. We'll talk to Robert now in Atlanta. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is, in Revelation, it talks about Jesus's kingdom, he's reigns forever. But in First Corinthians 15, I think it's 24, talks about turning after sin is abolished, he turns his kingdom back over to the Father. So I'm wondering, wondering about that. Is it have anything to do with not needing a mediator anymore?
No, it doesn't have to do with that. Yeah, it doesn't have to do with that because, Christ, as it says in Hebrews, Christ's priesthood is eternal. And what that means is, in fact, the Greek word there is aparabatos. And I don't know why I remember that right off the top of my head, but it's one of those interesting words. It means that it can't pass away. It doesn't end. So his priesthood is eternal. And what's interesting to note about that is that his sacrifice is also eternal. And as it says in Hebrews, I would read Hebrews chapter 6 through chapter 9 to get the full effect of this, because it's an extended discussion about Christ's high priesthood, really through chapter 10, excuse me, how Christ our high priest died once for all, and his sacrifice is not only not repeatable, but Christ our high priest is eternally offering this sacrifice to the Father. So back to your question, Christ's priesthood does not pass away, nor does his sacrifice cease, and it is in heaven being eternally presented to the Father on our behalf. So Christ is victim and high priest. So in 1 Corinthians, where it talks in verse 15, it says, then comes the end when he hands over the kingdom to his God and Father, when he has destroyed every sovereignty and every authority and power. Now note this in verse 25, it says, for he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. That doesn't mean that once he has put all his enemies under his feet, the last enemy in verse 26 is death, it doesn't mean that he'll cease reigning, doesn't mean that he stops being king. It just means that he is king up to this point, and of course, he will continue to be king of kings for all eternity. So in the same sense, in verse 24, when he hands over the kingdom to his God and Father, when he has destroyed every sovereignty and every authority and power, I interpret this passage to mean this is his act of being our high priest and the victim, and he is not handing it over like he ceases to have it, but he's presenting it to the Father. So this phraseology, hands over, it'd be interesting to look at the Greek and to see how that might be interpreted or how it might be translated in different ways. But I think it safely could be said that this is a way of saying that he's presenting all of this to the Father, but it's eternal and it doesn't leave his jurisdiction, so to speak. He doesn't cease to be the King of Kings when that takes place. It's a way of explaining how he's presenting this to the Father, I think.
Well, thank you for that explanation. It does help.
Oh, good. I'm glad. And, you know, it's always a good idea to turn to the Bible scholars, people like Scott Hahn and others who have commentaries on these things. It'd be interesting to see what they have to say. I'm certain there'll be far more interesting and maybe even very nuanced ways of looking at these passages. So I'd suggest that as well. Thank you. Let's go to Brooke now in San Jose. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Patrick. I just had a question for you. I'll make it really quick. I have a very bad habit of saying the Lord's name in vain, and okay. I do not have any malice. I love Jesus. I love the Lord. I went to confession this Saturday and explained this to the priest in my confession. And he asked me to do, you know, three Hail Marys as a penance, and then also a prayer I did with him where I said it three times, and then I mentioned my sins three times. And it went along as something like, I am the daughter of Jesus, and I repeated what he said three times over, and I can't remember that prayer because he suggested that I say it anytime I get tempted to use the Lord's name in vain. And I'm wondering if you knew what that prayer was.
I don't. I'm afraid I have not heard that before. Do you know the priest? I mean, you obviously know what parish you were at. Could you check in with him, maybe send him an email and say, I'd like to know what that prayer was? I'm sure he would help you.
Yes, I could do that. I just wondered if you knew, you know, whenever I have a question, I just think Patrick will know.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your confidence. I just don't happen to know what that is. It may be one that he composed himself, or maybe it's drawn from a prayer book.
Could be. And then I just wanted to say, Semper Fi, my son, just got out of the Marines, and I have great respect for the Marines and law enforcement. So I
As
just
do I.
wanted to throw that in there.
Is he still serving in uniform?
He is not. He just got out of his 4-year. He was a 311, I think it was, where he's like, he would be the first person in to if there were battle.
Yeah.
And but he decided it wasn't for him, and he's just kind of lost in trying to find what he wants to do. So I want to pray for him.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, I'm sure that if nothing else, serving in the Marines for as long as he did, a few years at least, that gave him a foundation in some ways that he didn't have before. So that's a good thing.
Most definitely. He came back a very polite young man. I'll say that much. So,
oh, that's good.
Anyway.
Hey, Brooke, if you don't mind, just in the interest of what you said earlier about your difficulty with lapsing into taking the Lord's name in vain, I just want to encourage you and actually applaud you because you're sensitive to this. Many people are not, and they take the Lord's name in vain all the time. And, of course, as you know, that is the sin of blasphemy. So I didn't want you to leave without giving a pat on the back to you because you're doing
Patrick.
The right thing.
I love the Lord and don't want to insult him in any way, and I try so hard to be in a state of grace as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Patrick. I appreciate it. Have a very blessed day.
Thanks, Brooke.
I always like talking to you.
Thank you. Well, the feeling is likewise. Thank you. How about a break? And we'll come back and do it again right after this. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio in the Relevant Radio app. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Looking for a new job? How about one that offers you opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/forester, an Illinois life insurance company not available in all states.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Hey, I wanted to let you know that as promised, we did post the link to that fictitious conversation that I shared with you earlier called Guess What, Mom? And this is in the wake of a call I had from a lady earlier about her sister who left the Catholic Church, and she's now, I think she's in some kind of a fundamentalist Protestant church now and buying into theories about the Catholic Church being just a kind of a later version of earlier pagan beliefs, et cetera, et cetera. We talked about that. If you didn't hear that, you can listen to it on the program, the podcast of the program, which gets loaded up on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, about an hour after the show is over. But I referenced this dialogue that I wrote back in, what was it, 1989, I think it was. It's a dialogue between a mom and her daughter calls her up and says, guess what, Mom? I've left the Catholic Church. So that is available to you, as are all my articles. They're all free. If you go to the show page, relevantradio.com, you'll see it there on the right side. But also, if you've gotten on my Telegram channel, I have a Telegram channel. It's just called Patrick Madrid Channel. And what's neat about this is some people say, well, I'm not on Twitter. I'm not signed up for Twitter, things like that. You don't have to be signed up to be able to receive this. But to make it even easier, if you sign up for my Telegram channel, I just push out these articles to you routinely. So you'll just get it. And there's no interaction. It's not like you respond or there's no conversations or anything like that. It's just a delivery system for me to get information to you. So it's yet another channel for you to get that. And it's called Patrick Madrid Channel on Telegram. So if you want to get that, you'll find the articles there as well. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Marty in somewhere in Texas. Is it Mejia, Texas? Is that right?
Yes, sir. It's supposed to be Mejia, but the locals call it Mejia.
I got it. Okay. Well, welcome, sir.
It's about 30 minutes east of Waco.
Okay.
Anyways, yes, sir. So I wanted to give my perspective on war. I'm a Marine Corps combat veteran myself.
Okay.
And there's six theaters of war. The sixth one has been talked about a lot lately. Well, it's been coming up lately in media. First, there was land. Then the second one is sea. And then with the invention of aviation, air became a theater of war.
Okay.
Next, you had cyber. Then space is considered a theater of war now. And the last one, which in my opinion isn't really the sixth, it's kind of the hidden first, is the spiritual theater of war, spiritual warfare. And I just want to share that perspective with your listeners and get your opinion on that.
Let's talk about that. That's a fascinating point you're making. So land, obviously, armies have been fighting on land forever and sea. Then air, got it. Cyber, get it. Space now. I imagine we'll probably live to see some altercations in space. But spiritual warfare, of course, would be the oldest, or at least concurrent with land and sea warfare. And that is the battle for human souls. I assume that that's what you're referring
to. Philosophy. It kind of ties in with the Eastern philosophy of Sun Tzu with, don't fight a war you haven't already won. And, through the use of technology, especially things like TikTok, you're having spiritual espionage happen in our culture today.
That's an interesting way of putting it, spiritual espionage. And isn't it interesting that the Chinese communists who are behind I just read an article over the weekend. Four of the top five most downloaded apps among young people are owned by Chinese companies that are in some way or another under the thumb of the Chinese communist government, TikTok being at the top. And isn't it interesting how they don't believe in God? The communists, by definition, at least they assert atheism as their outlook on life. And so they don't believe in God. They don't believe in the spiritual warfare per se. But I think in their eyes, this is more of a psychological operation. We could recognize as believers the spiritual implications and the way in which the evil one can work through things like this, even working through people who don't believe in God at all. And yet it has those effects. So what, in your experience as a combat veteran, can you share what you experienced or what you observed or what what your thoughts were about the spiritual dimension of war?
Well, during my time in the service, I recently came back to the Catholic Church back in last May, and I'm going to be confirmed here in about 2 weeks.
Welcome home.
I was raised somewhat Catholic. Thank you very much. I've done a lot of growing over the last few years. I'm going to be 27 in May as well. And I was very, went through the whole psychological trauma. I've been physically crippled partially. You know, there's plenty of people who have it way worse than me.
I'm sorry to hear
that. It's all right. I've dealt with it. Anyways, I was a very angry person for a very long time. It's cost me some relationships. And just living that life, and I feel not to victimize myself, but I've gave into that culture, went to New Ageism and all sorts of things, and you could understand the unless you've been through that, you can't really understand the mentality of secular people in trying to justify their actions.
How so? Give me an example.
I'm at work right now, so it's kind of like I'm trying to make sure I don't stay on here too long.
Got it.
So,
if you're not able to talk because you're at work, that makes sense to me. Obviously you want to give your employer your full attention. If you're on a break, I understand that.
Yeah, they're understanding.
Okay. Well, that's good. So the idea of the spiritual dimension or the spiritual battlefield, in the time that you have, is there anything about that that you want to say compared to land, sea, air, cyber, and space? Anything you want to say from your own experience about spiritual?
Well, yeah. I mean, troop morale is a huge issue. Whenever it comes to the transgender stuff, I mean, I think a lot of your listeners would agree that it's a mental illness. And whenever you have someone who's compromised, both like even just mentally, psychologically, like that, in a combat environment, it affects troop morale because maybe that person needs to get help, and now you've taken away mm-hmm. someone who was previously combat effective, and now they're no longer there, and then everyone else has to pick up the slack. So it increases the workload, which causes more stress on the unit.
Yes, I can imagine. I've never served.
Does that answer your question?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. It's an interesting perspective that you're bringing. I'd like to leave you with one thought here, and that would be, are you familiar with St. Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Society of Jesus known as Jesuits?
I am. I recently read up on him.
Okay, so you know his story about how he was crippled from a cannonball that shattered his leg mm-hmm. on the battlefield. You know about that?
I didn't know it was from a cannonball. I know that he became crippled in battle, yes.
Yeah. Well, then you already know the story, but I was just going to refer you to him because his story is quite powerful as a combat veteran himself in being wounded, and just recovery took forever. And you can mm-hmm. imagine without any painkillers or anything. And that's where he learned about God's call on his life. And he developed his own theory of spiritual warfare. So since you're already familiar with it, that's great. But I definitely think it's something for people listening to what you're saying for them to look into. We'll get a link posted to information on that as well. I'm glad you called, Marty.
A second quick question, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
I did spend some time in a non-denominational church, and mm-hmm. I'm ignorant of hierarchy structures of other religions, but non-denominational is so arbitrary that they had a bishop of the church. And do you know, like, what's your knowledge on anything like that?
You're talking about in the non-denominational church?
Yes.
Well, the term bishop comes from the term, well, it means more literally overseer, and it comes from that, it's actually a Greek compound word, which means to look over. You're overlooking something. And so one way that we translate that into English is bishop. So there are various groups who have an office that they call a bishop. And that doesn't mean that he's actually a bishop in the apostolic sense, because the apostolic succession of bishops in the Catholic Church is this chain of connection that comes from the apostles to the successors of the apostles today, the bishops. But in other ecclesial communities, or let's say in other denominations and things, not that the Catholic Church is a denomination, it's not, but in those denominations, they can have a position that's called a bishop as an overseer, but it's not a bishop in the sacramental sense. It would be just a term.
Yeah, I understood that, but it's more of like an honorary thing that they kind of gave to him.
Yeah, it can be that.
Most likely.
Can be that. Yeah, where the denomination might give an honor to somebody, like I'm thinking of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. They have an office of bishop that is, you know, at a higher level of leadership. That tends to be how they would use that.
I understand. Okay.
Well, thanks, Marty. Great talking to you.
Thank you, Mr. Madrid. Great talking to you, too.
Okay, you're welcome. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Kristen in Las Vegas. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Patrick. See, I just wanted to give some encouragement to the PA student, Maddie, that called from Minneapolis about an hour ago. Mm-hmm. I have been practicing as a PA for the past 7 years, and I would encourage her to take those interactions that she's had during PA school with her preceptors. And
can I interrupt and just say, for those who don't know what you're referring to, I think you're referring to physician's assistant. Is that what you mean by PA?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yep. Okay. Physician assistant. And I would just encourage her to take those interactions to prayer with the intention of preparing for future interactions. Because like she said, like she alluded to, she's going to make a larger impact on more established relationships. And she's going to run into these conversations for the rest of her career, no matter what specialty field she chooses.
So are you in the same boat, so to speak, where you have to know when to speak up and when to not speak up when situations arise?
Definitely. And I think it really impacts, like I said, the relationships that you already have established. For example, I had a conversation with one of my coworkers this week, who she is in a homosexual relationship and wanting to, quote unquote, marry this woman. And they're talking about IVF treatments and all that. And I thought, well, where do I reach her in this conversation? I think the most important part or more immediate thing is talking about the IVF and asking her the questions. Well, what happens to the frozen embryos that you don't use? What happens if you have many embryos that take?
What do you do with them?
Exactly. And I would encourage Maddie and all medical students, PA students, nursing students to take those interactions with your preceptors and take it to prayer. Think about how you'll respond in the future so you can make the most impact.
That is so wise, so wise. Because then you are using these experiences and learning from them for future good. It's not like you're just dealing with it in the moment, but you have a purpose for future interactions, like you said. I think that's very wise advice, Kristen.
Yeah, and I would hate for, like you said, it to get blown out of proportion if it's brought up in that happenstance, just an immediate conversation, and then it affects their schooling, their graduation, all of that, where they could make such a much bigger impact taking it into prayer and taking it into future conversations. And maybe those prayers will influence the field that she chooses to work in, whether or the company she chooses to work in. Right. If she would choose to work for a Catholic entity or, you know, someplace that does allow gender transition surgeries, does allow abortions, does allow all this. And how are you going to reach those patients in a professional manner, but also with your faith?
Good point. And you know, as you're saying all that, I'm also thinking about and wondering, I guess, about how often are the physician's assistants now, are themselves, do they become preceptors down the road? And so if you have people like you who have been so thoughtful and really internalizing these realities, when you become a preceptor, if you do, you'll carry that with you then, and you'll do an even better job with the people that you're training, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And she is probably working very closely with some of her preceptors, being nurse practitioners or physician assistants. I've been a preceptor myself once before.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you ever have to take a hit because somebody, I don't know how they do this exactly, but did they give you a bad evaluation because you didn't go along with some, you know, school of thought that wasn't moral? Did you ever have to pay the price for any of that? Or were you able to keep your head down sufficiently that you didn't have to deal with those things?
No, thankfully, I went to school long enough ago that I didn't have to deal with the thought of euthanasia and transgender surgeries, abortion, certainly, but I was blessed to be working with a doctor who actually dealt with infertility with the NAPRO technology through Creighton University. So I was very grateful to have that experience, and I'm sure I can't imagine what it would be like to be a medical student right now encountering all of these things as a very young person, and not that her faith isn't established, but just being introduced to these ideas right now.
Good point. Very good point. Well, I wish you were still a preceptor. You could be helping these young people now. But thank you for sharing from your experience, Kristen. I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thanks.
I'll be right back right after this.
keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, let's get back to the phones. John Paul in Passaic, New Jersey. You are on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. I'll bring something up from the past to relate it to something present.
Okay.
From 1809, I think that was the year, for about 5 years, Pope Pius VII had been the prisoner of Emperor Napoleon. Mm-hmm. And the reasons for that are a little complicated for now. But to my point, Pius sat down, took a pen, and abolished the whole hierarchy of France, which had been revolutionary compromised, and appointed an entirely new French hierarchy. I'm just wondering if Francis can do something like that with Germany.
Yeah, he could. The Pope has that authority. Whether or not that would happen, of course, is a different question, but I think that that stroke of a pen, as you described it, with Pope Pius, was it Pope Pius VII, I think?
Seventh, yeah.
As far as I'm aware, that was an unprecedented move. I'm not aware of that ever being done before. Maybe it was done a lot longer ago by deposing bishops in a particular region, maybe. But in theory, it could be done again. Now, you're alluding to the craziness that's going on in the German synodal process, right?
Yeah.
The craziness among the German bishops. Not all of them, but it seems like most of them, from what I can tell, just off the rails crazy. And any given pope could do that. Whether this pope will do that seems pretty unlikely to me.
Mm-hmm.
So
just wondering, just a thought. I think he'd make a lot of people happy and look at him in a brand new way. But since it's been done by Pius VII, it's now a precedent. It's a papal precedent.
True. Not all papal precedents are good, if you ask me, like abdication. I don't think that's a good thing to do, even though it's been done before. Well, looking at it this way, I do believe that in a material sense, many of these German bishops, not to mention priests and others, are materially heretical in the things that they're espousing, and in some cases formally heretical. So if a pope, whether this pope or a future pope, were to just to do what Pope Pius VII did, it seems like that would instantaneously create the circumstances for a formal schism in which they would say, okay, well, this is what we're doing, so we're going to be the Catholic Church in Germany now, or we're going to be, you know, some hybrid, and they would go off on their own. And obviously we would want to do whatever we can within reason to avoid severing part of the body of Christ that way. Sometimes it's inevitable, but I'm sure that any pope who's faced with that dilemma would be very reluctant to do anything that would cause it to happen in a formal way.
Pius VII, he was reluctant, of course, but he was dealing with the French Revolution. He was prisoner of Napoleon when he did it. These are really, those were bad, bad times. Abducting a pope and then making him a prisoner. And eventually when he looked at the ones that he removed, the bishops, they were in with the revolution. And as you know, the revolution was really a precursor of communism. And it was an anti-Catholic revolution. No matter what people say, that's really what it was.
That's true.
And we're looking at, in a sense, a revolution, but it's certainly not as aggressive and horrible as what he was dealing with. I'm just wondering if the thought has occurred to anybody at the Vatican, even if they're not going to do it.
I don't know.
Consideration.
Yeah, I could only speculate like you. I could only speculate.
Yeah.
I don't know. I know that, at least from what I've read, it seems that Pope Francis has a very high regard for the German episcopacy. maybe not these particular people, but historically, yeah, it seems that he has an affinity for the church in Germany. And I would say how lucky it is that we had a good German pope for the time that we had him. What an anomaly, you know, seems to coming out of Germany, of all places. But
yes.
Well, I don't know. Well, time will tell. Yeah.
Just, I would love to get that idea into somebody's head who might just to put it in the head, just to get somebody to think about it.
Well, you know? I don't know if Pope Francis listens to this program. He might. I understand he's a pretty busy guy. But
not only the station, he would do very well to listen to you every morning.
I'm pretty sure he's got more things to do, but if he ever wants to listen, I would welcome the Holy Father as a listener, that's for sure. Hey, you know, John Paul,
I'm going to recommend you.
Well, thank you for that. I just want to put a bug in your ear. There's a great author. You may already have read his work, the late, great Dr. Warren Carroll. Are you familiar with him?
You broke up for just a moment there. What was his name?
Dr. Warren Carroll. Does that ring a bell? He was the founder of Christendom College.
No.
Oh, you obviously are a man who's well-read in history. And so I would recommend his book called The Cross and the Guillotine. It's his book on the French Revolution. And it's just really good. And so, I'm sorry, Guillotine and the Cross is what it's called. And then he has a multi-volume history of Christendom. And the French Revolution has its own volume, and that is really good. So if you like to dig deep, that would be something I think you'll enjoy.
Yes, it's of particular interest to me, that area. And it's another area where more of the black legend has taken precedent over reality. I've always heard from everybody that revolution against the church was because the church was so tied to the hierarchy. And that was not it at all. It was a purely anti-Catholic revolution. They could say whatever they want, but they went so aggressively, killing nuns, killing monks, killing priests, killing anybody Catholic.
That's true.
It was beyond anything. It was disgusting. And every time I hear the Marseillaise, I want to punch somebody.
Well, a lot of people, I'll leave it at this. A lot of people, they only know what they've heard about the French Revolution from sanitized, you know, what they think they know about the French Revolution has been very sanitized and kind of glorified into something that it really was not. So,
absolutely.
I would not celebrate the French Revolution for sure. All right. Well, thank you for the call. I always enjoy talking to the fellow lover of history. Thank you for that, John Paul. 888-914-9149. That book that I mentioned a minute ago by Dr. Warren Carroll, it is called, It is called Revolution Against Christendom. And I believe it's the fifth volume in his series on the history of Christendom. It's really good, very readable. And then the shorter book, which is just about the French Revolution as well, is called The Guillotine and the Cross. And the author, again, is Dr. Warren Carroll, the founder of Christendom College. Shout out to Christendom College, by the way. We love those guys. Let's go to, where are we going to go? Let's go to Denise now in Cumming, Georgia. Hi, Denise. Welcome.
Hi. And actually, I went to Christendom for a year and a half before I got really sick. So shout out to Christendom College.
There you go.
I have a sister and a brother who are both religious life graduates from there. So
That's great.
I love that place.
Yeah.
I wanted to let you know I'm a teacher, middle school teacher, and this is in reference to one of your previous guests who called about taking the Lord's name in vain and struggling with that, and the prayer. And we start our classes, each class, with a prayer. And one of the prayers that we pray is the Golden Arrow Prayer. And that is a great prayer, honoring the name of God and making up for those, you know, for the times that you take the name of God in vain.
That's a good reminder. Do you have that prayer handy?
The Golden Arrow. I do. Do you want me to pray it?
Yeah. How long is it? Is it something you could pray?
Short.
Okay, yeah, pray it, please.
Short, very short. Okay. May the most holy, most sacred, most adorable, most incomprehensible and unutterable name of God be always praised, blessed, loved, adored, and glorified in heaven, on earth, and under the earth by all the creatures of God and by the Sacred Heart of our Lord Jesus Christ in the most holy sacrament of the altar. Amen.
Amen. Love that. Well, thank you for sharing that with everybody.
Sure. Thank you for all you do.
You're welcome. Let's go. Bye-bye. Let's go now to Dominic in Niles, Illinois. Good morning, Dominic.
Patrick, question.
Yes, sir.
John chapter 20, verse 17. Okay. My son posed me a question yesterday, and in his mind, he seems to think that Jesus is telling Mary to go tell the brethren or, you know, the disciples to lie. I'm kind of confused because he says, I have not yet ascended, but then in the same verse, he says, I ascend to my God, your God, so forth, and et cetera. Can you explain that possibly for us?
Sure, I'll try. So Jesus said to her, Mary, she turned and said to him in Hebrew, Rabboni, which means teacher. Jesus said to her, stop holding on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and tell them, I am going to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Mary of Magdala went and announced to the disciples, I have seen the Lord, and what he told her. So there is no contradiction here. He's saying, I have not yet ascended, and I am going to ascend to the Father. So there's no contradiction the way this is reading it from the New American Bible. I don't know which version he's looking at, but that's probably where his confusion is.
Exactly, and that's what I thought, but you know what? I just wanted to throw it at you, and I knew you'd clear it up for us. Thank you very much, Patrick.
You're welcome. Thanks, Dominic. Glad we can handle that easily. How about Cliff now in Huntley, Illinois? Good morning, Cliff.
Good morning. I just have a comment about patriotism and the and the drop in the number of people who are. I think that patriotism, a long time ago perhaps, was defined as the belief in the principles espoused in the Declaration and the Constitution. And I think somehow it has morphed into what it is now, which is patriots are seen as people who are far right in their politics, who are seen as being book burners or otherwise against the progressive positions. And so I that's why I believe that people don't see it as being important anymore, that it's been redefined.
I think that's a good point. In other words, the connotation of the word patriot now, for many people, it's synonymous with Make America Great Again, MAGA, or it's synonymous with Republicans, or it's synonymous with a wing to the right side of the Republican Party. I think you've got a good point there. And so to the extent that the way the question is asked in these surveys and people interpret it to mean something maybe other than what you and I would think of as patriotism, as just patriotism as such, I could easily see where that could skew things.
Yeah. I have another comment on autism, to go from 1 in 144 down to 1 in 36.
Yeah.
Perhaps there's an economic reason for that. I know that diagnostic abilities have changed, and they may be able to more accurately define all the different levels of autism, but perhaps the fact that more kids defined as autistic have to see more doctors many more times, drug companies looking to provide medication for autism, and even at the level of teachers' unions who say, gee, we've got more autistic kids in school, we ought to have more teachers who are qualified to educate autistic kids. So I think that there could be
There may be some economic benefit as a result of that, but and I don't know that this is necessarily what you were saying, but I don't think that is the cause of it. But that is an interesting story, or interesting theory. And it remains to be seen what is causing this steep increase in the number of autistic children. I'll keep an eye on that story for you. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.